All right, guys, so I'm here today with Anne Marie Waters, who is the director of Sharia Watch UK. Hi, Anne Marie, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Good. It took us a
Good.
while to solve
It
some of
did.
the
It
kinks, but we're here finally. I thought maybe, well, first I should say that the manner in which I first, quote, discovered you is I watched the now famous or infamous Oxford Union debate, where there was a motion put forth about whether Islam is peaceful or not, and you were arguing that it wasn't, and that's how I recommend everyone to check out that debate. Very interesting debate. So I thought maybe you could start by just telling us about the organization that you're heading. Tell us a bit about it, and then we could take it from there.
Well, so it's very small, fairly simple. What I want to do is to simply have a little record of what's going on Sharia wise, mainly in the UK, but we also need to focus on Sharia generally because Sharia is Sharia. And the men who are running Sharia tribunals here in Britain are of the same thinking of those who run them in Muslim majority countries. They openly admit that they want stonings and lashings and beheadings and all the rest of it. So we started off with a report on some of the organisations in the UK which people think are moderate. And in order to call them moderate, to my mind, you have to redefine the word moderate. And we do that a lot. We can have 78%, for example, of British-born Muslims said that satirizing Muhammad should be a criminal offence, and somehow we've managed to make that into a tiny minority. So nothing quite means what it means. So we wanted to show that these organisations, which are treated legitimately, people like the Muslim Council of Britain and the Muslim Association of Britain, who these men really are and what they really think, and to try to say to people, look, these are extreme views. Wanting people in jail for offending you is an extreme position, and that's simply what we tried to do. And the second one, I looked at Facebook pages for Islamic societies at universities in Britain and saw who they were having as guest speakers, and simply copied down who was guest speaking at various universities. We're talking known Islamists, jihadis, people who advocate for beheadings of apostates and all the rest of it, speaking with absolutely free rein in British universities while people like me are banned.
Right.
When I produced that report, I was rather ironically banned from speaking about it at least one university. The second, Manchester University, there was protests. They didn't want me speaking about it. But that's how crazy it is. I'm trying to point out at censorship of critics of people who advocate violence, while allowing the people who advocate violence to speak freely, and that's where we are. And I'm just trying to point it out.
What was the sort of original catalyst that sort of compelled you to get involved? And I ask this because I think there are a lot of people that see some, illiberal things, infusing themselves in the West. They'd like to contribute to the discussion, but somehow don't know how to go about it. So what was the mechanism by which you sort of awakened to this reality and said, well, I want to be involved in this discussion?
When I was a law student, I knew a young woman. We became friends on the first day, and stayed friends throughout. She was a Muslim woman, and I really was very naive at the time, didn't know anything about this stuff. And as I got to know her, I realized a lot. She told me about a lot of the pressures that were in her life. For example, she was being her family were trying to persuade her to give up studying law. She had two small children, and they wanted her to give it up. She desperately wanted to do it. She wanted, to her sense of herself, maybe some self-esteem. She wanted education for its own sake, and her family were hugely pressurizing her not to do it. She went to a doctor because this was becoming so stressful. The doctor was a Muslim. The doctor told her she was selfish. She ought to give up studying and go home. This was enough to make me think, whoa. But then she, very matter of fact, and quite casually told me one day that her sister was on the run in Scotland for leaving a violent marriage. And it sort of, when I thought, on the run? And she said, well, if my brothers catch her, they'll kill her. And this to me was, like I say, I was really naive, and it was the first time I'd ever been introduced to this stuff. As I was studying law at the time, I started looking into, a guy in my class had done a presentation on Sharia law, a Muslim guy, and I started looking into it, and I started reading about Sharia, and I literally couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was almost like growing up in an hour of reading and realizing not only how misogynistic this was, but that it was allowed to carry on in Britain. We have, as you know, several private tribunals practicing Sharia family law in this country. Fine, it doesn't have the legal weight of the British state behind it, but it doesn't mean it doesn't affect anyone. It doesn't mean it doesn't have any power. And I was incensed, quite frankly. I'm a woman. I don't want to be spoken about in this way. I don't want to be degraded like this. And I don't know. It's a personal thing, you know. You sometimes something happens, something triggers a passion in you, something triggers anger in you. Anger can be, it's not a great emotion, but it can be a very beneficial one in driving a person forward. And it really just started from there. I looked up some campaign groups that I could maybe work with and maybe give some legal advice to, or whatever it might be. And I found One Law for All, and I joined it. And that was really where it began. The journey began there. It's been twisted, and it's had a few twists and turns. But
so
it started.
How ironic that some of the people who might levy, you know, accusations at you that, you know, you're a white imperialist, colonialist, you're a bigot, you're a racist. What started your journey is your disdain at hearing about something that was happening to a Muslim woman, right? And that's often what's so ironic about the people who levy these accusations, is that in a sense, they want to keep the people many times from those societies held down.
Of course they do.
Now, how have you, I mean, have you received a lot, I mean, I suspect yes, but maybe if you want to talk about it, have you received a lot of the usual, but you're a white imperialist, British woman, you're a racist and so on? Have you had a lot of that stuff?
I get nonsensical emails sometimes, calling me a white whore, a white slut. These are not things to be taken particularly seriously. But I guess, no, it's not something that stands out, to be honest. I do get called a racist and a bigot and a fascist and a Nazi and an Islamophobe and all the rest of it. But people rarely point to me being white. I can't actually think of a time when anyone has called me an imperialist or a colonialist. But it's, I do get, obviously, right, get called a racist on a very, very regular basis. It never used to happen. When I joined UKIP, a lot of abuse started.
Right.
Particularly, you know, there were people who I'd worked with, people who'd, allied is probably a bit strong of a word, but people who didn't criticize me, let's say. And as soon as I joined UKIP, some of them were falling over themselves to say, I never liked her anyway. It was hilarious. And I don't think they realized that I actually laugh at them.
Can you explain what that term means, because many people might not be familiar with British politics.
UKIP. It's a political party here, the UK Independence Party. It's the only party in the country which wants common sense border controls for Britain. Not even the Conservatives argue for this anymore. There's a uniformity among the big parties in Parliament, Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem. None of them actually argue or advocate for a common sense border control. That's all it is. When you have no border, you have no country.
Right.
This is all UKIP is asking for, is some common sense border control, and to get out of the European Union so that the British Parliament can decide for itself. The representatives of the British people can decide what the direction of Britain will be. That's it.
Right.
It's roundly vilified by the left just for that.
Right.
Just for that. That's all. That's all it takes to be a racist and a bigot and whatever, Nazi. This is all the rubbish thrown at UKIP. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. It's to want control over your own country.
You know, we're facing, I say we in North America, facing this debate now. You know, we're sort of behind you on the trajectory as compared to Europe, but I think it's certainly making its way to us. Donald Trump recently made a statement, you know, one of the US presidential candidates about, you know, banning Muslim immigration. In Canada, we've had a similar discussion where the new Prime Minister Trudeau wants to push through with his promise to bring in 25,000 Syrians by the end of the year, and maybe even more. And so, of course, this type of debate we're having, what I wanted to do is actually read you, and you'll forgive me as I read you a large chunk from a speech that was given in the House of Commons in Canada. I won't mention who it is at first because there's a punchline to it. So bear with me. So this was given on October 1st, 2012, to a standing committee on immigration at the House of Commons. So here it goes. So the flow of immigration into Canada from around the world, and in particular the flow from Muslim countries, means a pouring in of numbers into a liberal society of people from cultures that are at best non-liberal. But we know through our studies and observations that the illiberal mix of cultures poses one of the greatest dilemmas and an unprecedented challenge to liberal societies such as ours, when there is no demand placed on immigrants any longer to assimilate into the founding liberal values of the countries to which they have immigrated. Instead, a misguided and thoroughly wrong-headed policy of multiculturalism encourages the opposite. Bear with me, because it gets good in a second.
It is.
We should not allow bureaucratic inertia to determine not only the policy, but the existing level of immigrant numbers and source origin that Canada brings in annually. We have the precedent of how we selectively closed immigration from the Soviet bloc countries during the Cold War years, and we need to consider doing the same in terms of immigration from Muslim countries for a period of time, given how disruptive is the cultural baggage of illiberal values that is brought in as a result. We are, in other words, stoking the fuel of much unrest in our country, as we have witnessed of late in Europe. Now, the next paragraph is going to be who the person is, because he's going to state who he is. So is this guy a Islamophobic, racist, Nazi, bigot? Well, let's see. Lest any member wants to instruct me that my views are in any way politically incorrect or worse, I would like members to note that I come before you as a practicing Muslim who knows out of experience from the inside how volatile, how disruptive, how violent, how misogynistic is the culture of Islam today and has been during my lifetime, and how it greatly threatens our liberal democracy that I cherish, since I know what is its opposite. Now, this is Professor Salim Mansour. I know him personally. I call him a friend. He's a practicing Muslim. He must be one hell of a Nazi, this guy, to be uttering all these words, huh? What do you think?
No, I mean he's not the only Muslim to say things like this, you know, and it leaves the lefties in a little bit of a quandary, doesn't it?
Right.
They don't quite know how to respond to that. They tend to ignore it. But you know, we just have to live in the real world. We have to live in the real world. Let us just look at the world and see how it actually is. The people who call me a racist and a bigot and all the rest of it, they simply don't live in the world as it really is. They live in a world of their own delusions, of their own fantasies. We live in a world of different cultures, different religions, different ways of life, different sets of values. We live in a world where people are influenced, their character is influenced by their surroundings, by the surroundings they grow up in. Not everyone, there are always exceptions, but the masses of people who grow up in a society will have their character, great parts of their character created by that society. They will have their values shaped by that society. Fact of the matter is, we have liberal democracies in one part of the world. We have Islamic theocracies in another. Another fact of the matter is that we are moving mass numbers of people from Islamic theocracies into liberal democracies, and no one has had the good sense, well, no one in any particular power at least, has had the good sense to say, hang on a second, will this work? What happens when we have a fundamental clash of values? What will we do? Will this work? It isn't working, which is why they had to introduce multiculturalism. to separate us all, to have two sets of competing values living in the same place. They're still clashing. Multiculturalism hasn't worked either because they're still clashing. We still share a public space. For example, if you want, you know, let's take the Muhammad cartoons. It's the perfect example. We in the West are used to satirizing religion. It's not a big deal. We don't seem to understand that we have in our midst a migrant population which will kill you for this, will kill you for this. And we've got no, we don't, how can you put peacefully and without a massive problems two groups of people, one of which wants to satirize religion and believes it has that right, and one which will kill you for doing it. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And before we keep importing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people from a society which is not just different from ours, but completely incompatible with ours, it's time we woke up, grew up and said, hang on a second, this isn't working. And by the way, we would like to defend our society, not hand it over, but defend it. And part of that defense has got to be keeping out people who threaten it. It's just common sense.
And that makes perfect sense. Now, the problem, if I play devil's advocate, is, of course, within the 100, let's take the number 100, within the 100 that we'd like to let in, there are many who not only are not ardent jihadists, but who really don't care, I mean, about those illiberal values. And they're perfectly happy to be given the opportunity to come to the West and live, you know, as anybody else does. You know, I escaped Lebanon. I mean, I'm not Muslim, but I escaped Lebanon. I was given a chance to emigrate here. I have many friends who are liberal Muslims or ex-Muslims. They're secular. So the challenge is, how do we implement exactly what you're saying, which obviously makes sense? There are people who come from those regions that are perfectly illiberal and perfectly incongruent with our values. But then there are tons of others who are, you know, are likely to be perfectly fine in terms of their trajectory of assimilating. So will we ever be able to resolve this, or will it end up being something like the extreme, call by Donald Trump of basically banning everybody, which that itself can't make sense, right?
The problem is the open borders. This is the problem. If you had a common sense controls over who comes into your country. The problem is we're not asking who these people are. The left wingers won't let us ask because that would be racist. All I'm asking is that find out who they are before you let them in. Find out who they are. Have a process of application. Find out who they are. You can't always tell. Of course, you can ask questions. You can tell a lot from the answers that people give. Why don't we ask them, what is your attitude towards women's independence? We're not even asking that question. Right. What's your attitude towards homosexuality? What's your attitude towards blasphemy? We'll do a couple of things by just asking those questions. One, we have control over who comes in. We should be an application process for who comes in. These questions should be asked. They will affirm our own faith in those things, in women's freedom, in gay rights, in religious and freedom of speech. We will affirm our own belief in those things just by asking those questions. If they don't give the right answers, don't let them in. If they give answers that are acceptable, let people come on a trial period. If you then find out that they are preaching death to Jews down in the local mosque, throw them out.
Right.
This is not, you're never going to get it perfect, right, but there are common sense, simple steps we can take. The problem is that we've just opened the border, let every Tom, Dick and Harry come. And when they do come and we know who they are, we know they're jihadis, we know they threaten women, we know they threaten Jews, we know they threaten gays, we do nothing.
Right.
We leave them there.
And certainly that's inappropriate. And of course we can implement the things that you're saying, but again, not to sort of be the bearer of bad news, but, so what somebody can, learn to provide the correct answers to let themselves in. So that's one, right? As somebody who designs surveys as part of my scientific career, people can do all sorts of machinations to try to answer in a socially desirable manner. But now let's even look at something maybe less sinister. The person might answer in a particular way that is consistent with our liberal values, but then one or two generations later, with the right mix, then the flames of illiberal values can be reignited in that person. So in a sense, it almost seems like it's an impossible problem unless you're able to take out any possible problematic interpretations from those doctrines. You're always going to be letting people in who downstream might cause problem, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, what the things I've said are merely one tiny, tiny element of what we could do. It would weed out some, but of course you're right. People will answer some people will answer the questions as they know they're supposed to, which is why we let people in on a trial period. But if it comes down to the doctrine itself, and the generations that you know, because in Britain we have second and third generation immigrants who are now becoming extreme and now extreme, I guess, more adherent. This is such a difficult question. If you really, really want to make sure there's no Islam whatsoever in your society, if that's what you want, then you have to stop Muslim immigration. That's the only way you're going to absolutely guarantee that you are not going to have jihadis in your society either now or in the future. I don't know if that, I don't think that's a moral position particularly. I
Well,
don't think
exactly.
it's a doable position. So it's different. Are we going to solve this altogether? I don't think we necessarily are, not unless Islam reforms. I don't think we necessarily are, but we it doesn't have to be as bad as it is.
Right.
You know, we can make some small steps, and what we can do in our own society, even with people who are coming in, is have a bit of faith in our own values. For example, I think we ought to be teaching in kids in school, British law, British democracy, the equality of women, that gay people are human beings. And we ought to be prosecuting crimes against them very, very, very toughly. So you can deal with people who are born here with strict application of the law and through education. We don't want, there should be no madrasas, for example, no Islamic schools teaching jihad to 4 and 5 year olds. So if you do that, your chances of a couple of generations down the line of producing jihadis are probably lesser. They don't disappear, but they're lesser. But if we absolutely insist, you live in Britain, you live by British laws. End of. If you don't like it, if you decide to commit a crime, if you marry off your daughter to some old pervert, you will go to jail and for a very long time. And if you're not a citizen, you will be deported. We've got to be tough. We've got to say, these are the values and the laws of this country. We will impose them. We will apply them. You know, you're not going to clear out every jihadi by doing this, but you'll be in a hell of a better place than you are now.
So certainly, if only by eradicating the ethos of multiculturalism, and again, here it's important for the viewers to know that multiculturalism can be used as a term in two ways. It could be used as a synonymous with plurality, right? It's a multicultural society. That's not what we mean here. Multiculturalism as a political philosophy basically says that when you let people into a host country, you don't necessarily force them or expect of them to assimilate. Rather, you perfectly appreciate the fact that different cultures have different moral codes, different values. And that, of course, is what leads to things like Sharia zones, correct? Because you're not fighting against the idea of people segregating themselves in neighborhoods. And what gives coverage to that possibility is precisely the political philosophy of multiculturalism, right?
Multiculturalism, especially by some on the left here in Britain, has been deliberately conflated with race.
Right.
So that if you criticize it, you're a racist, you're immoral. Race is obviously irrelevant. Culture describes how people behave. It is human behavior towards each other. Culture defines how we treat each other, how we behave, whatever, what. I said, actually, let me leave it at that. How we behave towards each other. That is essentially what culture is, the norms of how we treat each other. We invented multiculturalism because we found ourselves with a culture in our midst which treated each other in a way that was illegal. And rather than, different isn't bad, criminal is bad. So what we just, the reason we came up with multiculturalism is because we found that there was a culture in our midst, and it's the way it, its behavior, the way the people within this culture treated each other wasn't different. It was criminal. It was a criminal offense. So rather than deal with it, we came up with this lovely, morally lofty, you know how the lefties like to take the moral high ground, concept of multiculturalism. This allowed people to commit horrific criminal offenses. And it allowed the state to do nothing about it so that they wouldn't get called racists by the Labour Party and their minions. This is why multiculturalism exists. It's an excuse to do nothing and to not apply the law to Islamic bullies who will scream and shout racism at every opportunity. You know, there was one of the earliest cases of this was Ray Honeyford, a school teacher up in Bradford. All he wanted to do was teach kids about British life, about British value. He also wanted English to be the dominant language of these kids. And local community leaders but essentially ran him out of his job. They know what they're doing. They know that in order to gain the power that they want, in order to impose Sharia and their medieval ways on their own people, they have to defeat, they have to push us out. They have to push British people and the laws of Britain out of the equation, and they know how to do it. Shout racist. The lefties will love them. People will be terrified. You can go to jail in this country for being a racist. Actually, for being accused of being a racist can land you in prison if you get, and if you are unlucky enough to get a bad judge. People are terrified. They'll lose their homes, their mortgages, their jobs if they're accused of racism. And remember, it's a subjective test for racism. So if any, and it's not even just subjective to the person at the receiving end, but to anyone who might witness it.
Right, right.
Subjective. They said, well, I thought it was racist, therefore it's racist. Well, this is what people are up against.
That I think is one of the difference between countries that have hate speech laws, as is the case in many places in Europe and in Canada. And I guess there's one layer of additional protection that is afforded to Americans via the First Amendment.
Lucky them.
Yes. And by the way, although it is being tested, so it's not as though the problem is not seeping its way into the United States, but that extra layer makes it a lot more difficult to implement some of the things that you're talking about. I recently had on my show a wonderful First Amendment lawyer by the name of Greg Lukianov, who basically, his organization, they're called FIRE. FIRE stands for Foundation of Individual Rights and Education. They basically go after universities in the United States who, through the imposition of university speech codes, are effectively violating the First Amendment, right? You can't say this, you can't say that. You could only have a free speech zone in this particular area on campus. I mean, imagine how extraordinary it is in the United States to delimit a specific physical area where you are free to express your views. So somehow the discourse has to be taken. I mean, I call them the ostrich brigade. You might have seen me tweet a lot about that, because that's exactly what they are. I mean, right, they're unwilling, unable of accepting reality as it occurs, precisely because they are terrified, exactly from what you said, of being viewed as intolerant, illiberal, racist. And the reality is that many of the voices, and I'd like to include myself if I can, and I think probably you'd like to include yourself too, we're actually defending true liberal values, right? We care about women's rights and gay rights and Muslim rights and religious minority rights and animal rights and the rights of Jews and freedom of speech. Now, if that makes you a fascist, then I guess sign us up for being fat, right? So it's quite extraordinary how words are altered so that the current liberal value is anything but liberal. So the Liberal Party, for example, in Canada, takes positions that are astonishing in how fascist they are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're redefining language. You know, liberals are now the most, as you say, the most illiberal people. And extraordinarily, you know, it's you find now that it's the left, which was originally, or at least hold itself up to be, the defender of women's rights and the defender of gay rights and all the rest. And there was a time when it was.
Right.
Everything's been turned upside down. Now you'll find it's the more conservative-minded person who is actually speaking out for women's rights and gay rights by being the one to challenge Sharia and the awful, horrors that are committed, particularly against women
right.
in this country. And it's the left who's defending horrific practices, forced marriage, FGM, even the gang rape of young English girls in this country. I mean, I think the whole world now knows about Rotherham, and it's not just Rotherham; it happens in every town and city across England.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
I mean, we have a. It is happening across, as I said, across every town and city in England. It became a huge talking point following what was called the Jay Report. Professor Alexis Jay, she wrote a report. It was released last year, or might have been this year, and I think it was last year, saying that 1,400 young girls in the town of Rotherham alone had been gang raped by gangs of so-called Asian men.
Right. So you mean guys from Vietnam, basically, right?
Japanese guys.
Right.
Of course, these were not Asian men. There was no one from Japan or China involved in this, and there probably was a few from North Africa. These were gangs almost exclusively Muslim, and they are grooming and gang raping and prostituting girls 12, 13, 14 years of age. One estimate put it at as many as 1 million, potentially, English girls have been gang raped by these men and prostituted by these men, forced to take drugs by these men. And it's happening all over England. And for example, if we look at Rotherham, it was a Labour council, of course, who else, who... Let it happen, because they knew it was happening. They knew Muslims were doing it, and they didn't want to upset community cohesion by making a big deal out of it. So they allowed the rapes to carry on. I mean, we had a one woman who raised the alarm up in Rotherham. She won't go public about it, but she'd raised the alarm about it. And she said these Asian men, Muslim men, were raping girls all over the town, absolute impunity. And she was told never to mention this again, never to mention their ethnicity again, and was sent on a 2-day equality and diversity course while the rapes carried on. This is going on all across England. It's still going on, despite the outrage. But nothing's changed. Nothing at all has changed. I did a freedom of information request, and I'm going to be releasing a report on this before Christmas. I did a freedom of information request to every single, I'll explain what that is in a minute. I'll explain it now. We have legislation in Britain which allows you to write to every public, so the police or local, any public office, and request information from them, and they have to supply it. So I sent a freedom of information request to every local council in England and every police force in England, asking about how many girls in their area had been gang raped by groups of Muslim men. None of them could give me an accurate answer. Nothing has changed. They haven't changed how they record this information. They haven't introduced any robust criminal prosecution policies since the Rotherham report. Effectively, nothing has changed. But one thing that I did find out, which really strikes me, and here's the left again. Here is the left with its wrecking ball of morality and common sense again. What happens when these things, when local councils become aware of the gang rape of girls, some of them in the care, by the way, of the local council, they're legally responsible for these kids. When they become aware that these kids are being raped in huge numbers by gangs of Muslim predators in their town, they'll set up a committee to talk about what to do. Then they'll come up with a policy, which will be completely ineffective. The policy will be about bureaucracy and recording this and talking about that. And the idea that you should go out and arrest these men and prosecute them, gather evidence to prosecute them for rape, never occurs to them. The simple application of criminal law is not an option. They'll set up a committee, another committee, a subcommittee, a sub-subcommittee to talk about it, to educate and raise awareness. And all the while, and this thing can go on over years, and all the while they're setting up committees, subcommittees and sub-subcommittees to talk nonsense, the rapes carry on and not a single person is arrested. Well, here's an idea, lefties. Enforce the rape laws that already exist. You know who these men are. Go out and arrest them. That's what you do. You won't need committees and subcommittees. Just enforce the law as it is. I spoke to a woman who herself had been gang raped for years by these men. She gave the police a list of names. They are still, she's now a grown woman, those men are still going around her hometown and they are still raping young girls. And she gave names, addresses, even car registration numbers for some of them to the police. They did absolutely nothing. And 5-6 years later, those men are still walking the streets, still raping kids, and the local government is still sitting at a subcommittee talking about raising awareness. Get out and arrest them, you fools.
So then tell me this. I mean, again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. How would one counter the argument that, well, you know, this is about criminality, right? It's young men who are engaging in criminality, as would be the case in other groups, and hence not link it to one's religious background. For example, have there been statistical studies that have compared the prevalence of rape in Britain committed by people of different ethnicities or different religions? Are those stats available?
So in this particular kind, this sort of organized grooming and the passing, you know, families are often involved in this. You know, you'll have a more, maybe two, maybe three brothers, cousins. This is, you know, organized, premeditated, continuing gang rape of young girls. In this particular crime, Muslims are overrepresented.
Okay.
And the thing is, I mean, the majority of rapists are white, but then the majority of people are white.
Right.
So it makes sense.
No, but when you adjust per capita,
in this particular crime, Muslims are hugely overrepresented.
Okay.
It's to come back to the thing about criminality and it not being relevant to the religion. Essentially, what you're saying is that not you, but one is saying is that attitudes to women have no impact on whether or not a man might indulge in a little bit of gang rape. Of course it's relevant. Of course it's relevant, an attitude to a woman. You have men who, many of whom are raised from the cradle to believe that if a woman isn't covered up from head to toe, she's asking for it. And then you have these men walking around England's streets where girls wear, particularly in warm weather, some very small clothing. You have an attitude which is widespread, and I'll put a lot of this into, a lot of this will be in the report that I released before Christmas as well. Widespread attitude towards, not just towards women, and the belief that women should be covered and obedient and submissive is widespread among young Muslim men in particular. But the attitude towards white women,
right,
then you need that on top of that. And I read through various interviews with young Muslim men in this country. And the attitude of Muslim girl is for marriage, white girl is for fun,
right,
is extremely widespread. So when you have these kind of attitudes towards white women, which, by the way, are reinforced by imams. If you take look at Australia for a minute. Do you remember the gang rapes in Sydney back in, I think it was 2000?
I've heard of some of them, yes.
Of gang rapes by Muslim men of white Australian women.
I think they were actually, I think they were Lebanese men, correct?
Lebanese,
yes.
They were, but they were Muslims.
Yes.
You had the leader of Australia's biggest mosque, not the extreme fringe, this guy was the leader of the biggest mosque in Sydney, saying, you must know of this meat, uncovered meat speech.
Yes, I've heard of this, yes.
This is what they hear from their own leaders, their own imams, who tell them that if women are raped, they have no one to blame but themselves. These men are hugely influential on the thinking of young men coming up in Muslim communities, hugely influential. And when they tell, they are essentially giving license to these men to treat particularly white women, to treat women however the hell they please, but particularly white women, and to argue that this has no impact. This doesn't inform a man's decision about whether or not to gang rape a young white English girl. girl is absurd. Of course it does. Of course it does.
So a guy like this imam in Australia, if he utters such, you know, horrifyingly misogynistic statements, you're kind of stuck in a conundrum, because he hides under the cover of, well, it's freedom of speech and so on. Whereas, I mean, how would you go after him? Is it that he's effectively inciting violence against women by espousing these positions? I mean, how do you battle such a belief?
He is inciting violence. Okay. He is inciting violence. And that's a criminal offence. And it's been a criminal offence for a very, very long time. None of this came in with the hate speech, politically correct nonsense. Right. Incitement to crime has been a crime itself for a long time. And I don't actually have a problem with it. But it has to be direct incitement, which I think this qualifies as. How do we deal with that? You prosecute it.
Right.
You prosecute it quite firmly. And you prosecute it on the merits of the case. How much of a danger did this guy present to the woman walking down the street? The guy in Sydney, from what I recall, and I might be wrong about this, but I believe I'm actually not thinking of the uncovered meat guy now. I'm thinking of another guy, Fayez Muhammad, I think his name, or Muhammad Fayez. He'd made a speech to over 1,000 in Sydney. And he actually said the words, "When she's raped, she has no one to blame but herself." Now, this stuff has to be taken into account if you prosecute this guy. He's got 1,000 young men, A, listening to him, B, believing him to be a representative, essentially, of God's word, and to be teaching God's word because he's an imam. And these are devoutly religious, perhaps most of them devoutly religious people. How much impact are his words actually having? How much of a danger is he? Does he represent to women? Is he sending out 1,000 young men there potentially to rape a woman? I think he is. He should be prosecuted severely for that. If he's not a citizen, I would deport him. Right. Absolutely, in a heartbeat. If he's a citizen, severe punishment within the law here. If he's not a citizen, get out. And you're not coming back. You represent a danger to our women. Get out.
See, I mean, my position is this. Everybody should be free in the privacy of their thoughts to believe whatever it is that they want. But in a secular society, at no point should the exercise of your religion infringe on a single other third party. If you simply implement this very simple concept that I just said, you already solve a lot of problems. So, and it doesn't, of course, this doesn't apply only to Muslims, right? If a Jewish guy comes and tries to impose some kosher law on the rest of us, which would infringe on my right to not be exposed to his demand, then he has failed that secular test. So the bottom line is, we welcome anybody. You could be brown, yellow, blue, purple. You could be of any faith, Muslim, Hindu, Jew, atheist. Believe whatever you want in the privacy of your own conscience. But once you agree that you wish to live in a secular liberal society, never, at no instance, do we concede one inch in terms of your capacity to infringe on the rights of anybody else. If we apply that law uniformly against all belief systems, then I think we'd go a long way towards eradicating some of these problems, no?
Of course. I mean, this is, if you take FGM for an example, you're allowed to believe FGM is a good thing. You're allowed to believe that a girl should have her clitoris cut off. But you're not allowed to cut it off.
Right.
Right? You're allowed to believe it, but as soon as you do it, then you become a criminal and should be punished. So people, we've twisted up the language again. We've twisted up, for example, the concept of freedom. The one freedom you don't have is to take other people's freedom away. Now, this sounds common sense, doesn't it? But you will hear it. You will hear people arguing that they should have the freedom. This is freedom, isn't it? I thought we lived in a free society. If I want to mutilate my daughter, it's my freedom, right? No, because she has the freedom to have her body intact as well. The freedom you don't have is to take other people's freedom away. And this, again, brings us into the paradox with Sharia. They argue freedom of religion to have Sharia courts. It's our freedom of religion, isn't it? But what it's actually set up to do is to remove other people's freedoms, including their freedom of religion. So no, the freedom to take other people's freedom away is the one freedom you don't have. This is simple, simple stuff. But it's being manipulated and twisted for the benefit of you know who, the jihad.
Speaking of Sharia, incidentally, I mean, you often hear people either because they're ignorant of the specific tenets of Sharia or because they're duplicitous, that 99% of Sharia is perfectly consistent with the American Constitution and so on. I mean, that is so profoundly laughable. I mean, it's shocking that someone. I mean, there's the guy. I don't know if you know him, Imam Rauf, who was the
Of course, I do now.
okay. So he, he would make the rounds on all the, the American stations, saying, "Hey, there's so much overlap between Sharia and the American Constitution." Well, so let me just give you one, foundational way by which they couldn't be more antithetical to one another. Under Sharia, depending on the religion of the perpetrator or the victim of a crime, establishes the punishment. That's it.
Right.
I don't need to say I don't need to say a single other word about Sharia, right? That is the most fundamental violation of the principles, sort of Western law, right? I mean, that's it. We're done. I don't have to say anything else. So, I mean, it's just astonishing that Western journalists can hear somebody espousing something like this, and either because they're ignorant or because they're, fearful of appearing racist, they don't challenge them and say, "I mean, what the hell are you talking about?" Right? I mean, so. Now, of course, usually the cover will be, well, there's different ways to interpret Sharia, and you don't need to talk about the harsh punishments. I mean, anybody can read Reliance of the Traveler, which is sort of the foundational sort of treatise of Sharia law, and go through it and see if it is consistent with Western sort of secular law. It isn't. So, anyways, maybe you want to comment on
I
that.
mean, you don't even have to read Reliance of the Traveller. You just have to look around at the world and see it and observe reality. That's all we need to do. Look at the countries that implement Sharia law.
Right.
They've all got the same oppression. They're all as oppressive as each other. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion don't exist, and the treatment of women and homosexuals is abhorrent from countries which are otherwise completely different. If you take the two big ones, the big Shia, the big Sunni, Saudi Arabia and Iran, remarkably similar punishments. What can the common denominator be?
Right.
You know, if you even go into Somalia, Sudan, countries are completely different in every way from, say, Saudi Arabia, but yet which have the same grotesque punishments. What's the common denominator? You know, you have the jihadis and Islamists in Nigeria, same punishments. Boko Haram, same punishments. Stonings, lashings, amputations. They're all completely different people from completely different cultures, completely different parts of the world, yet they have all these horrible punishments in common. Where are they getting it from?
Well,
What's the common denominator?
here's the
It's
answer.
Islam.
Here's the answer of a member of the Ostrich Brigade.
Right.
What they have in common is that they are all not true Muslims, right? So that's the no true Scotsman fallacy, right? So somebody who sits as the Grand Sheikh of Saudi Arabia, who ostensibly you might think is somebody who by definition is profoundly knowledgeable about Islam. Well, if I speak to a Western apologist, he'll say, "Oh, why are you quoting this guy? He's no true Muslim," right? So, right, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, right, the head Sunni cleric of the Muslim Brotherhood, perhaps the most famous alive cleric today of Sunni Islam. Many times I've been told he is not a true Muslim. So, I mean, imagine the level of ostrich logic where you could actually espouse such a position without cracking a laugh, right? I mean, it's right. But again, I think in many cases, in some cases it's sinister, but in many cases, and not that I wish to be charitable to the Ostrich Brigade, but it really comes from a good place. I mean, in an idiotic place, but it comes from a good place where people simply don't wish to demonize everybody under one umbrella. And so they're stuck, right? Because they don't know how to otherwise navigate through these daily realities that you are speaking of. How do we get them to get cured from their ostrich parasitic syndrome?
I don't know if we can. I really don't know if we can. I don't know if we can find a place where we bring them with us, or whether we just have to push them out of the way and carry on without them. I think it's probably
and
the
we're
latter.
talking here, by the way, before you finish, we're talking that nobody posts any hateful. We're not talking about the Muslims here. We're talking about the Western
I'm talking about the
apologists.
lefties.
Yeah,
Yeah, the lefty has become mainstream now, sadly. But yeah, I mean, look, it's absolutely extraordinary. Our government here is they're all Islamic experts. You know, you would think by the way they talk, ISIS is not true Islam, and Islam is a religion of peace, and they haven't got a clue. I can guarantee you, Theresa May has never sat down and read any of the Reliance of the Traveller or the Quran or any of the Hadith, and yet she's somehow an Islamic expert. The lefty brigade, look. I'm not convinced that they are all coming from a nice place. Some of them are. Some of them are, like you say, they just don't want to demonize. You don't necessarily have to demonize, though, to tell the truth. I mean, to me, demonization suggests untruth, whereas all I want to do is tell the truth. But I'm not convinced. Like you say, some are coming from a nice, decent place. I'm not convinced the activists are, though. I'm not convinced that the left wing, the left wing, the Left Unity, Stop the War Coalition, Unite Against Fascism. I'm talking all about British groups here. I'm sorry, but these are not coming from a nice place. They know exactly what they're doing, and I hear it a lot, or they're misguided, or they're gullible, or they're stupid. I don't think they are. I think they're anti-West. And I think they're anti-West because they're constantly saying things that are anti-West, and they see, and look, let's be clear about something as well. You know, the Islamism, the political philosophy of Islamism is quite left-wing one. If you look at let's take the caliphate, for example, it doesn't recognize national borders. It rejects nationalism of any kind. It's a big state. They believe in big states. I've heard Islamists even advocate for everything, energy, food, clothing, and shelter to be provided by the state. They're very anti-freedom. They're very anti-capital, anti-free, certainly Western-style capitalism. And they hate Israel. Now, there's no mistake that the left has aligned itself with and jihadis. It's because they're ideologically, there's a cigarette paper between them ideologically. I mean, Islamists don't believe in human equality, whereas lefties pretend to. But ideologically, this is one of the only, probably the only major thing that separates them. So it's no mistake that the left has so aligned itself with jihad. It's because they hate the West. And I think the anti-Western left, which is very powerful in this country, sees a very useful ally in jihad has aligned itself completely with that ideology, and is kind of licking its lips and rubbing its hands and thinking these guys could actually crush Western capitalism, which is the ultimate aim of the far left. So I don't think they are coming from a decent place. The activists most certainly are not. They have a deliberate agenda to anti-Western agenda.
Well, and I mean, to add to your comparison, I mean, and I guess you alluded to it already, they both their sort of defining ethos is that the collectivist
Sure,
or the
right.
collective trumps the individual, right?
Sure,
So in
absolutely.
classical
Oh,
liberalism, you start off the central starting premise on which everything else is built is the individual. And so already there you've got, oil and water that can't mix, right? Is it the collective that's more important, right? I mean, in Arabic you say the ummah, right? The Islam
yeah.
nation. So that's a problem, right? Because right there you do have a clash of civilizations, so to speak. So I mean, do you see, maybe as we kind of draw to the end of our chat, maybe we could try to end with some hope. Is it possible for us to coexist in peace? Is there going to be a nice resolution to this, or do you see this going from worse to worse until we'll have house to house fighting all over the world? What's your general feel?
I think it's probably going to get worse. There is no middle ground. There is no middle ground on a lot of this. I'm not saying that human beings can't find a middle ground, but ideologically speaking, there is no middle ground. You cannot have a society where you have death for blasphemy and freedom of religion. It's one or the other. You have to admit that fact and decide which one it's going to be. Sadly, we certainly in Britain, not necessarily directly, but by implication and by our passive lack of action, lack of defense of freedom of speech, we are actually giving way to blasphemy, for the reintroduction of blasphemy laws. I don't see any easy answer for this. Someone's going to have to lose. Someone's going to have to win, and someone's going to have to lose. You know, we've been so dominated by the left wing again. You can tell. My contempt for the left is only possible for someone who was once a part of it. I do have contempt for the left, I have to say.
You were a leftist, then you grew up.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, they have taught us that, you know, when you win an election, you still have to put the policies of those you defeat into, you know, this is the kind of thing. There's no winner under left-wing ideals. They've taught us that everything has to be compromised on. Let's get together and let's hammer out a compromise. We can't do that on this. There's going to have to be a winner, and there's going to have to be a loser. At the moment, I am not convinced that we're going to be the winners, unless something changes very drastically. It will only change, I think, there will be violence if it changes, because if we start to stand up now, which we need to do, we need to risk that violence. We need to perhaps even take that violence in order to restore the primacy of democratic liberalism in the West. We're going to have to stand up and do some very controversial things, do some very difficult things. We're going to have to start admitting that this is a religious issue. This is not about Western foreign policy. It's not because we bullied somebody. You know, if only America were nicer, we could all get along. This is absurd. This is a war of religion, and it's been waged on us, not by us. Until we admit a lot of these harsh realities, until we take some firm steps, until we stop the open borders and actually ask, who are you, and will you fit in to our society?
Right.
We're not going to alter society to accommodate you. Will you fit into our society? If the answer is no, you reject these people. They don't even sound that harsh, but we're so wet and wimpy that this has become, common sense has become controversial. And I can tell you that if we did this stuff, if we went in and arrested imams who are marrying underage girls in this country and shut down the mosque, which is what we ought to do, there would be riots in the streets. So we need to risk that. And if there are riots, we need to contain them.
Right.
But we have to do it anyway. If the riots are going to happen, we're going to have to deal with that, but we have to do it anyway. We have to bite the bullet. We have to stand up now and take real action against these people, or we will go out with a whimper. Our society will.
And what do you think about the role that Muslims can play? So, for example, I know that there are several activists within Britain who are, in some cases, were former Islamists. I'm thinking of Majid Nawaz, but there are others who now are sort of leading, at least in the context of Britain, leading the sort of voice of reform. Do you think that that strategy might also help in that, by finding a way to reinterpret text and so on, this might allow some of the problematic passages to be expunged and hence allow us to live in peace better? Or are you looking for more sort of radical and quick solutions? Or both, or maybe we can be having a multiple prong approach to hopefully solving this issue. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's both, and I think, you know, what people like Majid and Osama Hassan and some others, what they do is very valuable, and I've got a great deal of respect for them. But this, to me, is an internal matter among believers of Islam, and shouldn't affect the British, wider British society's rights to protect its laws and its values and its norms. You know, while you know, Muslims can have a debate about reform of their religion, absolutely, but it's completely separate. We should still be applying the law. We should still be arresting people who arrange child marriages. We should still be prosecuting FGM. We should still be arresting people for inciting violence against women and against Jews. This, you know, the argument for reform inside Islam shouldn't affect the legal
Right,
application,
of
the
course.
application of Britain's laws. It's a two completely separate thing, and the British shouldn't have to stand back and allow Muslim communities to completely live outside or break the laws with impunity because, oh, they're having a reform. Right. Let's let them get on with it. I don't care. If they're you know, if this is good stuff, fine. But I'm not going to sit around right. and wait until they have their argument and their reform before we start to stand up for women's rights in this country again and apply the law and protect women in this country. Why should women have to wait while they argue it out? No, we apply our laws, and Muslims can get on with debating while we still apply the law.
That's a good place to end. Now, is there anything that you'd like to promote or give a shout out in terms of any projects or your organization? I will be putting at the bottom of the clip various websites and so on. Is there anything else while we're
on? Of course, yeah. Please, if you could put shariawatch.org.uk.
Okay.
The site's not in great deal in great form at the moment because it's being rebuilt. We get hacked daily. We're being hacked. Okay. So that's being sorted out. So the site's pretty quiet, has been for a while because it's being rebuilt. But shariawatch.org.uk. And I have got, as I said, between now and Christmas, I'll be writing a report on what happened. I'll be releasing a report on what happened when I tried to find out how many girls have been raped by Muslim grooming gangs in Britain. And I'll write a full report on that, and it'll be out by Christmas.
All right, great. Thank you so much for joining me, Anne-Marie. I'm going to stop the thing, but let's stay on for a second. Here we go.